Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Russian President Vladimir Putin, in his annual address to the nation, threatened to use new weapon systems to target countries that host offensive missiles and countries that deploy those missiles, calling out the United States in particular. Putin said that Moscow is not seeking confrontation with Washington, but that it objected to the recent U.S. decisions to withdraw from the INF Treaty and to deploy U.S. missiles to Central and Eastern Europe. We're joined from Columbia, Missouri by Stephen Starr, a professor at the University of Missouri who teaches in the Peace Studies program on the environmental, health, and social effects of nuclear weapons. Stephen is also a senior scientist for Physicians for Social Responsibility. Welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
I'd like to get your thoughts on exactly what President Putin said. We have a clip from his, we're calling it his State of the Union address, and why don't we run it now?
I said it earlier, and I would like to repeat that. Russia does not have any intention, and I emphasize this once again, Russia does not have an intention to place such missiles in Europe. Russia does not want to be the first in placing these missiles. But if such missiles are produced and supplied to be installed in Europe, and the U.S. does have such plans, this will definitely create a new spiral in the in their security system, because the time to fly to Moscow could be between 10 to 12 minutes, and that's a serious threat for Russia. We will be forced, again, we will be forced to take appropriate reciprocal measures.
So does he have a point there? Is this a real threat to Russia?
Yes, of course, you know, the INF Treaty, the Intermediate Nuclear Range Forces Treaty that the U.S. is abrogating, it goes back to the mid-1980s when there were Pershing 2 missiles there in Germany that could hit Moscow in less than 10 minutes, and that's what got a lot of this stuff. You know, back then, they were actually concerned about preventing nuclear war, it seemed like. And at this point, there's an open question, too, about the U.S. ballistic missile defense sites that have been placed in, there's one, an active one in Romania, another in Poland that's, you know, supposed to become operational very soon, because those sites have what they, it's a dual use launch system. It's a Mark 41 launch system that can accommodate a variety of missiles, but they can also, they're designed to accommodate Tomahawk cruise missiles, two different types. And the U.S. has programs in progress right now that are doing upgrades that will be quickly implemented to Tomahawks to have probably about a 300 kiloton nuclear warhead on new Tomahawk missiles that have a longer range. And these, the Aegis Ashore systems that they're called there in Poland and Romania should have the capability to launch up to 100 to 200 of these missiles, you know, in a very short period of time. They can change the targeting in less than an hour. And the missiles are, you know, and all those facilities come in containers that are closed. You can't tell what's in it, you know, so there's no way to inspect it visually. And they're reprogrammable. They have the same mechanical and electrical, you know, interfaces. So, in other words, and Putin talked about this in December 2016 in Oslo, I believe it was, in an international conference to a group of journalists. There's a speech you can look up on Google called Putin's Warning. And he specifically addressed this issue that, you know, the U.S. was, you know, we call it missile defense, but these are, since there's dual use systems, Russia has no way of knowing whether or not the U.S. has substituted Tomahawk cruise missiles that are nuclear armed there, which could be basically used as a nuclear first strike in a very short period of time. And I didn't mean to talk too long about that, but there's a new article in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists by Theodore Postel, a professor emeritus from MIT, that addresses that. It was written February 14th.
We are speaking with Professor Stephen Starr. He's a professor at the University of Missouri who teaches in the Peace Studies program on the environmental, health, and social effects of nuclear weapons. He's also a senior scientist for Physicians for Social Responsibility. Stephen, the former Soviet Union, or really just Russia now, is ringed by countries that are generally friendly to the United States.
Right. Well, NATO's expanded the Russian borders.
It's expanded right to the Russian borders. What is it politically or even militarily that the Russians can do to protect themselves from offensive weapons that might be placed in places like Poland or Romania or the Baltic states? Is there anything that the Russians can do?
Well, the Russians have maintained an enclave in Kaliningrad. You know, with the abrogation of the INF Treaty, they'll be able to place medium-range missiles and hit all the NATO targets. But what they can do, you know, what you can do about it essentially is you have a military or political choice. And you know, we choose the military route, then the really only, the most logical thing to do, if you think there's, you know, 200 or 400 nuclear armed cruise missiles that can hit you in 9 or 10 minutes, and then you take it out. But once you have a direct military conflict between the U.S. and Russia or NATO, then that just opens up the question is where does that stop? And the thinking has always been that you have to prevent that because, you know, with all the electronic capabilities and things we have now on launch-ready nuclear weapons, you can escalate this in milliseconds, you know. So the big problem really is political. You know, it's how do you stop this cycle of escalation in terms of, you know, there's no dialogue and you can get rid of the arms trees. There's no mechanisms for inspection. There's no cooperation. We've just been going down that path for some time now, but it's getting, you know, painfully obvious how dangerous the situation is becoming.
The conventional wisdom is that the United States withdrew from the INF because the Chinese are not a part of the INF, and they scored propaganda points by saying that the Russians had violated it in the first place. But you flagged an article for us that appeared in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists saying that it's both Russia and the United States that may have violated the treaty. Can you explain to us how that was?
Well, your point about China is well taken. They weren't a part of the INF treaty, so they've got a lot of intermediate range missiles that can hit Guam and all these bases of the U.S. So that's been a U.S. concern. It may have been U.S. thinking that we could withdraw from the treaty and then try to go back to the table again and get China in as part of it. But, you know, I think that was really stupid, frankly, if that's what indeed was what they're thinking. That Russia, U.S. has accused Russia of violating the treaty because of a certain missile type that it has. That Russia actually, you know, made a lot of efforts to have an open inspection of the missile and, you know, try to deal with this. But the U.S. didn't seem to want to have any part of that. And I mentioned the issue of the ballistic missile defense systems. You know, Putin in a speech there in Oslo said, well, you know, you don't, it's not necessarily defense because these systems can be used offensively, not only for a first strike, but also as mop-up systems. If, you know, if you initiate a first strike and then you take out 95% of the offensive forces, then you can use an interceptor system that's limited to take out, you know, the few missiles that might come back at you. So there's a lot of different ways to look at that. And that was some of that wording was included in the New START treaty by Russia, which explicitly said if you continue with the deployment of these more advanced phases of the hypersonic interceptors, we're going to have to, you know, deal with this. We reserve the right to withdraw from New START. And I think as time has gone by, they've become increasingly more concerned about the ability to put the, you know, more updated Tomahawks in there too.
I think that people need to understand how all of these potential catastrophes seem like they won't happen because they're not happening. If you went back and asked everybody in 1912 and say in Austria or in Serbia or in France or in Germany, everybody except perhaps the socialist anti-war movement, will there be a world war? Could there be a world war? Could there be a war in which, you know, 20 million people are killed in like 3 years, which is what actually happened? And most people would have said, no, that's madness. But because of all of the different blocks and arrangements and security treaties, and the fact that there was an unmanaged rivalry between great powers who had larger issues dictating their agenda, and those larger issues were who's going to control Africa, who's going to control the Middle East, who's going to control Latin America, who's going to control Asia. They were competing with each other. But sure enough, relatively small events triggered a sort of a cascade of events, and we did have a world war. And then 20 years later, a second one where 86 million people died. It seems to me that we're playing with real potential catastrophe by, again, in this case, by the United States feeling we are the 700-pound gorilla. We can sit wherever we want to, and thus everybody else will roll over. But Putin made it clear today Russia is not going to roll over, nor could they really roll over, and the Chinese won't roll over either.
Well, I think the World War I analogy is very good because in that circumstance, too, you know, all the nations had basically built up huge arsenals. They had big armies. They trained for war. It's sort of this process that got put in place that, you know, then all it took was a bit of a, you know, a diplomatic incident to trigger the war itself. Today, I think it's actually much more dangerous because, you know, we've got our cyber electronics and everything and launch-ready nuclear weapons. I mean, the U.S. and Russia each have, you know, something like 800 to 1,000 strategic nuclear warheads they can launch within a matter of 2 to 15 minutes at each other. Things, and, you know, if you put your military forces and close proximity to each other. I mean, the U.S. has, you know, actively been building up forces for NATO. And we did military exercises in Estonia, which is within artillery range of St. Petersburg. It's Russia's second largest city. That was when Russia was having its 75th anniversary, you know, victory over over the Nazis in World War II. We didn't take part in that. Instead, we choose to have war games the same place that they were attacked from in Operation Barbossa. I mean, there's so many things that have happened that right now the Russophobia that's in the U.S., that's one of the most alarming things I've seen, because, you know, it seems to me we're actively preparing the American population for war. And then that's one of the things that you would typically do if you're planning on having a war. So, but where is the recognition of what war actually is? I mean, you know, I wrote an article for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists several years ago about the effect of a Russian 800 kiloton warhead on Manhattan. And, you know, you create a fire zone that nobody can escape from. It's at least 90 to 150 square miles. And that's one warhead. You know, if you get hit with, you know, 200 or 300 of those, what's left?
Yeah, not much. We will leave it there. We were joined from Columbia, Missouri by Professor Stephen Starr. He's from the University of Missouri, and he teaches in the Peace Studies program on the environmental, health, and social effects of nuclear weapons. Stephen is also a senior scientist at Physicians for Social Responsibility. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Three British Conservative Party parliamentarians quit the Tories and joined eight former Labour MPs in a new independent political group that looks like it's becoming a bona fide political party. The Conservatives left the party over Brexit, while the Labour members, who are widely considered to be centrist Blairites, accused their former party of anti-Semitism. The new independent group is now the fourth largest political grouping in Parliament, along with the Liberal Democrats. We're joined from the UK by Jess Cobbett. She's a researcher for a British Labour Party Member of Parliament. Jess, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Jess, this is big news. When the news broke of these eight Labour Party members breaking off, people were already sounding the death knell for Labour in the next election. But then, lo and behold, three Tories broke off yesterday, and all of a sudden there are 11 independents in Parliament. The Liberal Democrats have 11 parliamentarians. So it seems to me that this is a potentially serious political force. What are we looking at here?
Yes, exactly. It's very fast-paced politics at the moment in the UK. It's hard to keep up with it. This is basically just now a product of how divisive our political system is at the moment as a result of Brexit. And so, yes, we have the original seven MPs and now eight Labour MPs and three Conservative MPs who have been actually uniting on the front around the people's vote, which has kind of been coined as the second referendum, giving the choice back to the British public, because Parliament is absolutely at a deadlock. As we've seen over the past multiple months, we haven't been able to get through anything, and it doesn't seem like we've developed forward at all. So this is just a very interesting time. It's unique, and yeah, it's maybe an area where there's common ground between parties and trying to have come together for different reasons, but ultimately Brexit is the driving force.
Let's talk for a few minutes about Brexit. Theresa May had trouble getting anything done in her own party. In fact, she had failed to get much done in her own party relative to Brexit. And certainly the EU negotiators are unwilling to entertain additional new negotiations. How does this weakening of her parliamentary position affect the Brexit vote? Is there any chance that this will have to go back to referendum?
Certainly seeming more plausible.
Wow.
The reality is, at this point, I mean, I know that there's a lot of the front benches on both parties, but both Labour and the Conservatives are not keen for this to happen. But the reality is, there really just hasn't been any difference in Theresa May's deal over the past 3 or 4 months. And she keeps coming back to Parliament, presenting the same exact deal. And one general consensus that Parliament can get to is that we don't want a no-deal Brexit. And that, it seems to be Theresa May's tactic at the moment, is to kind of play chicken with this and run down the clock and drive this her deal. And she keeps putting this on everyone else, saying, well, the only way to avoid no deal is to accept our deal. So I can't see at the moment anything moving us on other than a second referendum, although I know that's not that popular.
Let's talk about what this new development means for Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. The parliamentary wing historically was more opposed to Jeremy Corbyn. The Blairite wing of the party certainly very opposed. They didn't expect Corbyn to rise to the position and to the popular position that he has both in the party and in the country. Is this a serious challenge to Jeremy Corbyn's leadership?
I honestly, I'm not entirely sure what this will mean in the long run for Jeremy Corbyn, because he has faced his fair share of challenges as a leader. He has run two leadership races because of how contentious he is as a leader. And it seems that it is just basically his leadership is more so cementing the hard left and into supporting him. Labour has the biggest membership base of, I believe, any European party, and well, one of them at least. And so it's an extraordinary turn of events where actually it seems that it's splitting the left, but it's not necessarily meaning that he's going to be the one who suffers for it. It's a very interesting time. I mean, I'm not scared for his leadership the way, you know, people would have been 2 years ago, you know, when he first, or over that now, when he first started.
What's the popular mood? Of course, there isn't one popular mood, but with the masses of people, would the majority now welcome a second referendum? And two, it would seem that the impression would be the referendum will be held until the vote is taken in a way that conforms to those who are actually organizing the referendum. In other words, we didn't win the first time, so we're going to do it again to win the second time. Won't that be considered to be sort of a negation of basic democratic principles?
That is one of the biggest arguments against it. There are a lot of people, a lot of key members of parliament who are very vocal about how a second vote would be anti-democratic, which I think is part of the reason why it's kind of been coined the people's vote as opposed to a second referendum. We know so much more 3 years down the line than we did when the first referendum took place. But in addition to that, you know, even the day after, we basically found out that a lot of the claims around the Leave campaign were lies. And actually, the Electoral Commission have come forward and said the Leave campaign ran on over its budget and was technically then illegal, and yet nothing has been done about it. A second referendum, I think, would be split in, people would think of it as, I think people are a bit exhausted of Brexit at the moment, and I think there is this mentality of, oh, just get on with it. I can't be bothered to deal with this again, because a referendum would just drag it all out. But at the same time, I believe it's close to 80% of Labour membership who would be in support of a people's vote, which is part of the reason why Original Seven split from Labour, because they felt that Labour was actually ignoring their own membership base. So the reality is it's extremely divisive, and I can't imagine that going down any particular route will answer any questions, but it'll have to be resolved at some point. But I think the most likely thing that's going to happen now is the government will be forced to extend Article 50, giving the UK more time to figure out what we're doing.
Tell me a little bit about the political role that this new independent group is going to have in Parliament. I would have to assume that their respective parties are furious with them for leaving the fold and creating this new independent group. Is there a role for them? Are they going to be courted? Are they going to be asked to re-caucus with one party or the other?
Yeah, I mean, I think the important distinction is that they are not technically a political party at the moment. So they are independents. They're a collection of independents. There are actually, you know, other independents on top of them that already have left parties. But they're trying to make sure that they're not just kind of associated with any leftover MP that doesn't have an affiliation. Again, there's a split specifically from Labour's perspective. I think there's two approaches to this, which is, yes, absolute anger and fury, saying that, you know, the split has actually just kind of enabled another Conservative government. You know, you're selfish, and this move is going to help austerity to continue. But then you have a more empathetic side of the party, who would arguably be a bit more aligned to them as centrists, who are saying, hold on a minute, there are real underlying issues. You know, there's no smoke without fire. We need to address this before just kind of saying to everyone they need to just go away and, you know, get on with it. So it will actually be very interesting how leadership of both parties approaches this. I know that Theresa May has said that she feels thankful for the work that the three female Conservative MPs have put forward over the years, but I'm not sure what the message has been so much from the Labour leadership on this.
Jess, in our last minute, tell us what you're hearing in the halls in Parliament. Is there a chance or is there an expectation that other members of either Labour or the Tories are going to break off and join this independent group?
Well, I can't say I've personally heard anything, but I can definitely, I wouldn't be surprised. I absolutely wouldn't be surprised. Jess Phillips is another Labour MP that has spoken about how disappointed she is in Labour, and basically her, depending on how the leadership responds to this breakaway and the roots of the issue will determine whether or not she stays. So I wouldn't be surprised. It's in a very divisive time, very fast politics, and it's quite hard to keep up.
Well, that was the voice of Jess Cobbett, who joined us from the United Kingdom. She's a researcher for a British Labour Party Member of Parliament. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The U.S. Supreme Court on Tuesday declined to consider the Maryland Attorney General's bid to revive a state law aimed at preventing price gouging by pharmaceutical companies. The court let stand a circuit court ruling that it was a constitutional violation to try to stop Big Pharma from raising the prices of medication. We're joined from Baltimore by Dr. Margaret Flowers. She's a medical doctor and the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. Check out their work at www.popularresistance.org. Welcome back, Margaret.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Margaret, I have to repeat this because it just defies all logic. The Maryland Attorney General is not allowed to try to rein in Big Pharma's medication prices. They're blaming the Constitution's Commerce Clause, but is there any way at all for Americans to have the same kind of low medication prices that everybody else in the world has?
You know, there is, but unfortunately, it's not probably not going to come from the state level. You know, this court decision really tells states that, hey, you're not allowed to control drug prices in any way. And although Maryland is looking at other alternative ways to probably accomplish this, all of them are fraught with conflicts with federal laws, and so they may not work. And so, you know, this just beckons to what we really need to do, and I've advocated for so many times on your show, is we need a national health insurance of some sort, either a national Medicare for all or a national health system, because then you bypass these obstructions and we can control drug prices.
I think you're absolutely right. You know, so many Americans who are able to cross the border into either Mexico or Canada to buy medications and then essentially smuggle them back. You're really not supposed to bring them across the border. But I've done that. I had an aunt, my father's sister, who was suffering from cancer, and she had prescribed medications that were just far too expensive for her income. She was just living on Social Security, and I would drive her to Canada every 3 months, and we would buy her medications and smuggle them back. But it's the only way to make ends meet and to be able to take the medicine that you need to stay alive. With that said, you operate in these circles. Margaret, are you aware of any serious move afoot at the federal level that might make it easier for Americans to get the medications that they need?
Well, I mean, in terms of serious, you know, there are various bills out there, and there is a new bill coming for a national improved Medicare for all healthcare system that we're pushing really hard, because a component of that will be that the health system will negotiate with the pharmaceutical companies for fair prices. This is what other countries, you know, all other wealthy countries have some sort of universal healthcare system. This is what they do. They have the power because they're a single purchaser. If that drug company wants to be able to sell their drug in the country, they are forced to negotiate with the government for a fair price. And it still allows them to make somewhat of a profit, a reasonable one. But in the United States, our drug companies get away with incredible price gouging. And as you said, the impact is real people's lives suffering and preventable deaths because they can't afford their medications. This is really criminal.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that was happening in the prison system when I was there is I think it was Gilead that developed an injection that was a cure for hepatitis, I think C. and it was very, very expensive, more than $1,000 a dose. And the government is compelled by law to provide that medicine to prisoners who need it. Well, it's expensive and they didn't want to provide it. And so they just started letting people go. You know, the Bureau of Prisons made a decision that they would ask the Attorney General to ask the president to either commute sentences, or they would elect to send prisoners to halfway houses, community confinement, just to get them out of BOP jurisdiction so they didn't have to pay for this medicine. Imagine what the average American does.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you mentioned going across borders, and there are also online pharmacies that people are using to purchase medications from outside of the country. And actually, the FDA has reported that they're actually seeing a huge increase in the number of people that are doing it because they try to stop them coming through. They don't catch all of them, but they're seeing a huge uptick in that. People are really desperate. I mean, we're hearing stories of young people who are dying from diabetes because they can't afford their insulin, people who are rationing their insulin. This is just really inhumane that this is happening.
Again, one of my favorite phrases from the past couple of weeks, the tyranny of capital. Here you have states' attorney generals trying to represent people in their state. You have mass movements. You have people all over across the board, including like Dr. Margaret Flowers, healthcare professionals.
That's right.
Who want their patients to do well. They're treating their patients. They want the best for them. And bottom line is the pharmaceuticals or the insurance companies, the owners of capital. And that's what this is. They can turn these things that we all need into commodities for their profit. They're the power. They're the power. The Supreme Court says, how dare you, state attorney general, think that you have the right on behalf of the people that you purportedly represent to do anything to lower the cost of generic drugs that were doubled, the price doubled in the course of a year, which in any other system, that would be just not just price gouging, just thievery, like the worst kind of corruption. And yet the power rests with capital.
It really points to the corruption of our legislatures, where these industries go in and they make huge donations to the people in Congress and they, you know, push them to change laws or change the wording in laws to protect their profits. And the corruption of our legal system, as you said, that completely defends this when the cost is human suffering and life. And it doesn't happen in other wealthy countries. This is what we have to remember over and over, that other countries don't treat healthcare as a commodity like we do in the United States.
No, they treat it as a right, as a human right.
Here, I mean, you know, I was just listening to radio this morning on the way in, Republican legislators up in arms because I think it's the state of Illinois. Yeah, they increased the minimum wage to $15 an hour by the year 2025. And so that's the thing that they're focusing on. Or the opposition to a minimum wage, the opposition to health care for all. In other countries that are kind of mature or advanced capitalist countries, it's not even a right-left issue. I mean, it's not a political issue at all because it's kind of like the way Social Security is now. You know, once it's in place, or Medicare now, once it's in place, the idea of taking away this valuable benefit becomes almost inconceivable because everyone benefits from it. And so the politicians can't pretend it's like an ideological or political thing. And it's not ideological, actually. They're just the shills for these pharmaceutical companies or the tyranny of capital, the real power. That's who's paying them. Those are their actual real constituents.
Margaret, I want to ask you about this specific law. This law was unique in the United States, and what it did was actually kind of complicated. It applied to generic or off-patent drug makers that manufacture medicine that at least three other companies also make. Okay, so these aren't proprietary drugs. If those conditions applied, companies couldn't impose a significant price increase without justifying it to the Attorney General. And the Attorney General could ask a judge to order that the price increase not take effect. And it came with a $10,000 fine. So this only would have affected generic drugs. Is there any other law that you're aware of that might provide relief for people who can't afford their medications, or is the whole system broken?
I mean, I'm not aware of any other laws. I mean, there are proposals for laws that would try to rein this in, but I'm not aware of any laws that are doing this, except, you know, if you look at things like the Veterans Health Administration, which is a completely socialized health system in the United States, and they are able to negotiate for prices for the pharmaceuticals that they provide. They actually, it's a really amazing system because they also have a board that looks at the different medications and which is the most effective, and they provide unbiased information to their health professionals, because we're, you know, on the outside in the private sector, you're bombarded constantly with these drug pushers coming into your offices and trying to push you to use the latest, most expensive drug when it isn't even proven that they're better than what we've been using all along. So, and you're working, and it's really, you know, you're working a lot of hours, and to get that information is very difficult. So we need a health system that actually is about health and can provide good information to the health professionals.
In our last minute, I just wanted to make a quick comment and then get your thoughts. The Maryland Attorney General, he's a Democrat, he said that Congress could seek a remedy. This is after he came out of the Supreme Court having lost. Congress could seek a remedy, but so far it's been unwilling, and this is his quote, to prohibit the kind of price gouging that we have gone after. One last stab. Is there anything that anybody can do in the short term so that we no longer have to read these stories about people rationing insulin and other medications and then dying because they don't have access to their medicines?
Well, I mean, I think we're seeing people acting in desperation and trying to get these medications by going across the border. I think that's going to continue and increase. And other than that, it's just really pushing on members of Congress. We have a new health law that's coming out very shortly that would create a health system that would be universal and that would negotiate for these prices and cover them, so that people don't even have out-of-pocket costs like copays. You could just go to the pharmacy and get your medicine. That's what we need to be advocating for right now.
That was the voice of Dr. Margaret Flowers, who joined us from Baltimore. She's a medical doctor and the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. You can find their work at www.popularresistance.org. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at several big stories. First is our segment In the News with Jackie Lookman, where we talk about Bernie Sanders' announcement that he's running for the Democratic nomination, Donald Trump's attempted coup in Venezuela and the danger of a U.S. war against Venezuela, and the effort by the Trump administration to pull the plug on a high-speed train rail system linking Southern and Northern California. And then we host our weekly segment called Beyond Nuclear. We take a look at nuclear issues, including weapons, energy, waste, and the future of nuclear technology in the United States.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. A unanimous ruling today by the U.S. Supreme Court struck a blow against the law enforcement practice known as civil asset forfeiture. This practice involves the seizure of property owned by people accused of a crime. It's long been the target of harsh criticism by those who say it's little more than a mechanism for police to steal from the public. The United Nations announced the imminent start of a mutual withdrawal of military forces from the Yemeni city of Hodeidah. Forces backed by the United States and Saudi Arabia have been battling forces loyal to the Houthi movement that controls the country's capital of Sana'a. Hodeidah is a port city that serves as a vital humanitarian lifeline for millions of Yemenis. Three immigrants have died in Border Patrol custody over the past 3 months. This week, a 45-year-old man died in Texas near the U.S.-Mexico border. Immigrant rights advocates say that the Border Patrol routinely denies adequate medical attention and other care to those in their custody. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman wrapped up a visit to India today. He and Prime Minister Narendra Modi signed a major deal involving infrastructure and trade. MBS had previously been in Pakistan and will move on from India to China. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our look at the news so far this week. It's Wednesday. That means it's time for our weekly segment called In the News, where we look at the most important ongoing developments of the week and put them into perspective. We're joined from Washington, D.C. by Jacqueline Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. We're normally joined by Walter Smolarek, but Walter is not feeling well. So if he's listening to this, and I know he is, Walter, we hope you feel better. Jackie Lookman, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Right before we went on the air, we were talking about the Bernie Sanders campaign. Big news, because Sanders, obviously, as a Democratic socialist, is probably the most left-wing or the most liberal, however you want to phrase that, within the Democratic field so far. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I haven't followed it all that closely. But Donald Trump doesn't want to run against Bernie Sanders because Sanders could actually beat Donald Trump. He can speak to some of that same base.
In fact, if I could interrupt you for a second, only Sanders and Biden in the latest polls are leading Trump by more than the margin of error. Now, some of that, of course, can be attributed to name recognition, but otherwise, it points to the real strength, true strength that that Sanders and Biden have right now politically.
And Sanders is also the target of the Democratic Party establishment. We know they cheated him in the 2016. They wanted to make sure he didn't succeed. He wasn't supposed to even be there. It was supposed to be the Hillary Clinton coronation. And then millions, literally millions of mainly young people came out and said, yeah, democratic socialism sounds good. No more student debt sounds really good. High paying or decent paying jobs sounds right. Anyway, Jackie Lookman, it's a war by the establishment on both parties against Sanders right now. Of course, we're not supporting any particular candidate, certainly not on this show. But Sanders brings something different to the table.
Yeah, Sanders brings a perspective of lifting the working class, of actually focusing on the working class in his campaign that I don't think any establishment Democratic candidate has right now. He's weak on some issues. Obviously, Sanders is weak on being anti-war and anti-imperialism. He's still got issues that he's got to strengthen with actually saying racial inequality. He has a campaign video out that is really, really great, but I have a serious problem with the fact that he calls racial inequality just inequality. He doesn't say racial, and that's a problem he's consistently had, that he doesn't want to offend white voters. That's why he does that. So he's still stuck in that really, really difficult headspace in that issue. There are definitely other things that need to be criticized about him, but Sanders is the only Democratic candidate that has a class consciousness, a class focus, that's focused on the working class and the poor in his campaign. Biden doesn't even have that. I don't think Biden can pull that off in a convincing manner that's going to pull enough people away from Sanders. And the interesting thing is there are so many candidates in the Democratic race right now that if Sanders can get 30%, then the rest of that 70% is going to be divided up by all of those Democratic candidates. And statistically, Sanders comes out on top. But that does not mean that the Democratic establishment is going to be fair and actually let him win the nomination. I actually doubt that.
Jackie Lookman is making an important point, John. And, you know, I was talking to some friends just yesterday about it. When you look at the fact that there's so many contenders and Sanders has this core support of maybe 30%, somewhere along those lines, it looks like out of that kind of field, he wins, right?
That's right. The more people who jump in, the better for Sanders.
But on the other hand, you have the real sort of power in America, which isn't lodged within, you know, primary voters. It's lodged within the media.
That's right.
It's lodged within the big well-financed think tanks. It's lodged in the military-industrial complex, and it's lodged in Wall Street. And they have many, many, many ways to influence the outcome.
And we don't know, really, the effect of the DNC's so-called reforms after they essentially stole the election from Bernie Sanders in 2016. They supposedly reduced the number of superdelegates. We don't really know to what, and there still are superdelegates. So the DNC, with the support of the media and Wall Street and the think tanks, et cetera, could still steal this primary election from Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, and I think what we can anticipate, because I don't think they're going to let this happen. Now, Bernie Sanders, I want to just back up a little bit. Bernie Sanders says he's a democratic socialist. Bernie Sanders' actual political program is an FDR, New Deal, liberal form of Democratic Party governance. That's what it really is. I would say the same goes for Ocasio-Cortez and the other people who are calling themselves democratic socialists. It's the old liberal wing of the Democratic Party.
Right.
But that part, that wing was extinguished during the Clinton period, during the 1992 and beyond, and including Obama. So the liberals and the liberal wing of the party that advocated for a bigger social insurance program, or back in 64, Medicare, or the unemployment insurance in the Social Security program of the 1930s, nowadays that's considered to be like luxury goods, something, a kind of communism, something that's going to bankrupt the country. And because Sanders has come back and really represents this kind of liberalism that is no longer in vogue in this new stage, the latest stage of capitalism, which is cut, except the military, and give all of the money of the national treasury to the already affluent through tax breaks or through government contracts. So Sanders represents a dire threat, not to capitalism. It's not socialism versus capitalism, but to some of the egregious sort of excesses of the current capitalist system, the way it's being managed. And as a consequence, I think all the Democratic Party aligned newspapers will start to attack Bernie Sanders. Any vulnerability that Sanders has, whether there's the allegations that there was some sexual misconduct, not against him, but by some people in his campaign in 2016, there's any other number of vulnerabilities that Bernie Sanders will have, all of them will be accentuated, because the goal will be basically to stop Bernie Sanders and to stop the liberal wing of the Democratic Party from becoming ascendant once again. Go ahead, Jackie.
Yeah, exactly. This is not what I see a lot of people online. Sanders is not like fomenting what people are calling a revolution. Yes, it is a change in the way the current Democratic Party operates. It is a shift to the left of where they currently are. But like you said, Brian, the current Democratic Party isn't even quote unquote liberal. I can't even say they're moderate Republicans right now. They're basically Republicans who call themselves Democrats. The Republicans are a fascist party right now. And Bernie Sanders is basically just moving the party a little bit to the left away from being the Republican Democrats. But the focus on not supporting corporate interests so much, or forcing corporate interests to share more of their largesse with the working class, with the people who provide them their profits, make their profits possible, that's something that the Democratic Party does not want to happen, because they get paid by those very entities. The lobbying from the corporate interests is how we get these pieces of legislation passed that erodes protections for working people. So, I mean, Sanders has a tough road ahead of him. Everything is going to be dredged up against him, but he really has to stay on message. I don't like to tell people who to vote for. Sanders really does have to stay on message, and he has to not shy away from the criticism that's going to come at him.
Indeed. That's the voice of Jackie Lookman. She's the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. She joins us every Wednesday on Loud and Clear in this segment called In the News, where we take a look midweek at the big news stories of the week so far. Jackie Lookman also joins us on Friday in an hour-long segment called The Week in Review, where we look at the stories again as they've evolved since Wednesday. John and Jackie, let's go on to another story. And it says so much about what's actually wrong with the U.S. government, and that is that the Trump administration has announced that it is pulling back, withholding $1.6 billion in federal money.
Outrageous.
To the state of California so that a high-speed railroad could connect Los Angeles and San Francisco. And this is retaliation because California filed a lawsuit along with 25 other states against the national emergency, so-called, declared by Trump to divert monies from other programs to build the wall. Again, here we have China, Japan, Europe. People are building high-speed trains, but the United States, no.
I'll tell you, I was on a high-speed train for the first time in my life a few weeks ago from Paris to London. It was like traveling in paradise. It goes so quickly, you practically barely have time to read a newspaper and you're at your destination. And that's the oldest high-speed train system in the world. China has state-of-the-art high-speed train, something that everybody should be emulating. God knows we have the money to do it if we wanted to do it, but we prefer to spend our money on border walls and military equipment.
Yeah, and Jackie, Trump tweeted this morning, I think it was this morning, maybe it was last night, that the reason he's not giving the money for a high-speed train in California is giving the money to the wall is much less expensive and much, much more important for the country.
I mean, I don't know how many times we have to say on this show and everywhere that there is nothing critical, important. There's no emergency at the southern border. It doesn't exist. There's no need for Trump to basically hold a state's funds hostage. This is a ransom. I mean, this is a ransom, basically, that Trump is doing, holding this money hostage until the governor of California withdraws the lawsuit against the administration for building this wall. It's petty. It's retributional. It's unnecessary. But this is what he's going to do rather than closing down the government, because, see, he can't do that again, because that was so incredibly unpopular. But he can do this and still present this aura of strength and look, I'm, you know, to his base, look, I'm fighting for you, and I'm especially sticking it to those, you know, liberals in California. And all he's doing, once again, though, is making life difficult for the Americans he claims that he is fighting so hard for. I mean, California needs this high-speed rail system. Newsom scaled, I think, the project back a little bit so that it wouldn't cover the full distance between L.A. to San Francisco, but it is still going to be built. A section of that is still going to be built. That's necessary for a place like California, where travel is already so difficult, and it would improve jobs, it would improve mobility for people in the state. But Trump decides that because he can. This is his way, again, of bullying people to get money for his completely worthless, useless, and honestly racist wall, that this is his tactic now. And it's just the latest ring in this circus of this administration.
One thing, you see the leaders of different countries, whether it's China or Japan or European countries, everybody's about infrastructure and technologically advancing society, providing the sort of state-of-the-art infrastructure. In the United States, we have a situation where the president of the United States, the CEO of the federal government, is actually celebrating what he hopes will be the demise of a high-speed rail in California. He's actually celebrating. He tweeted, California has been forced to cancel the massive bullet train project after having spent and wasted many billions of dollars. They owe the federal government $3.5 billion. We want that money back now. Whole project is a green disaster! Exclamation point. It's kind of like the president of the United States declaring war against the largest state in the United States. And who's we? We is Donald Trump. He is now the representative of the nation of the federal government. And then Governor-elect Newsom tweets back, quote, fake news. We are building high-speed rail connecting the Central Valley and beyond. This is California's money allocated by Congress for this project. We're not giving it back. The train is leaving the station. Better get on board. Well, you know, maybe the train is leaving the station, but if you have enough obstacles thrown in its path by the federal government, which apparently is content to smash political opponents rather than build infrastructure, the train won't be leaving the station that quickly. and it certainly won't be leaving at the same speed. Remember, during the Obama administration, money's allocated for across Florida, east-west,
right,
high-speed
rail. Desperately needed.
Desperately needed to connect the Gulf of Mexico with the Atlantic Ocean. The Republicans in the state smashed the project because it was coming from the Obama administration. So we live in a democracy with federalism and states' rights and blah, blah, blah. The fact of the matter is the bridges are falling down. The high-speed rail is not being built. The money is being – the only thing that there's unanimity about in the country is that endless amounts of money must go year after year after year to the already disgustingly obscene, already bloated military budget. That's the point of unity for America's elites. Nothing else.
Yes. And I just thought of something. You know, Trump has declared this national emergency where he can take funds from other budget categories in the American budget. Well, he really doesn't want to take money from the Department of Defense, even though that was an idea. So what's the next best place to take it from? States. The states. That's what this looks like to me. He's really not going to take money from the Department of Defense, but he will take it from the states. And this is just one way to do it.
He knows he can bully the states, that a lot of them don't have recourse, especially when it comes to block grants. If he can catch them in time, he can withhold that money. And there's nothing that the states can do except sue him in federal court and let that drag on for years.
Yep. Let's go on to another story. Donald Trump and Mike Pence have declared themselves president and vice president of Venezuela now. They issued a statement, Trump did. He tweeted this: "I ask every member of the Maduro regime, end this nightmare of poverty, hunger, and death. Let your people go," all caps. "Set your country free. Now is the time for all Venezuelan patriots to act together as one united people. Nothing could be better for the future of Venezuela." So here we have a situation where Trump has basically said, and Pence have said, to the Venezuelan military, to all of the commanders, "Hey guys, make your decision. You either can defect right now and we will amnesty, or you're going to end up with sanctions, maybe going to prison. We're threatening an invasion. If we catch you, we're going to either kill you or send you to Guantanamo." I'm paraphrasing, but you know, that's the basic core message. I mean, we've spoken about this before. Can you be more brazen about regime change than this? And again, John, Biden in his tweets, he sounds like Trump.
Oh yeah. His tweets they might have slightly nicer language, but the bottom line is the same as Trump. And it's not just Biden. It's most of the Democrats running for president.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Jackie, you know, I'm talking to people who are in Venezuela. Almost every day I'm talking to them, and journalists, and they're like, the streets are normal. There's food. Some of the food prices are unattainable, but there's not a sense of crisis. But you know what? The U.S., because the coup is going badly, I believe the U.S. is moving now for Plan B, which is a military operation. And not just at the Colombia-Venezuela border, but perhaps at the Venezuela-Brazil border, because both countries, Colombia and Brazil, have pro-American right-wing governments. Maybe if Trump can't succeed with his appeals for all Venezuelans to unite against Maduro and for military commanders to defect, the U.S. will try to do in Venezuela what it did in Grenada in 1983 or Panama in 1989, what it tried to do with the Bay of Pigs in 1961 in Cuba, use its own military apparatus to carry out military action. What do you think?
Yes, I think that's exactly what they're going to do, because I think it was just yesterday, representatives of the Venezuelan military who have not defected from supporting the democratically elected President Maduro made it very clear that, listen, you can impose your sanctions, talking to Trump and Pence and Pompeo. And I think the Venezuelan general actually named those people in his press conference and said to them, listen, we're not going to not support our homeland of Venezuela. So you want to impose sanctions? Go ahead and impose your sanctions. You know, you want to do this or that thing, that's fine. But we're not going to abandon supporting our homeland, especially now we know that the coup is failing and that the United States is losing the PR campaign for their coup, even in Venezuela, because Russia, China, and other countries have reportedly sent 300 tons of humanitarian aid to Venezuela, including medicines and food. So there is no reason. There is no reason for the Venezuelan military to defect.
Jackie, this is a little bit off the immediate topic, but I'm curious about your views on this. These competing concerts that are supposed to take place this weekend. Why would Richard Branson, the founder of the Virgin Empire, why in the world would he be, why would he want to insert himself in the middle of this thing and host a concert on the Colombian side of the Colombian-Venezuelan border? It seems so provocative and so politically out of character. I just don't get what his point is. Do you have any views on that?
You know, I read that and I thought, the only thing I can think of is he sees this as an opportunity to make more money. I cannot think of any other reason that he believes that he is going to, he and his company are going to benefit hugely financially from supporting this coup. I don't know how, though. It makes no sense. It came out of nowhere. I wish I could figure that one out, but that one was completely out of the blue and threw me for a loop. And I'm still trying to figure out what's going on.
We know for sure he's a useful prop for the coup makers.
Oh, yeah.
I want to turn to another story. Time is going quick. We have less than 5 minutes. While any protest against the government in Venezuela is widely publicized in the mainstream media, what's not widely publicized is the massive protest going on in Haiti by the Haitian people. Again, it's a tale of two countries when it comes to media coverage. Jackie, what's going on in Haiti and what about that media coverage?
It's very interesting what's going on in Haiti because it's actually connected to Venezuela and it makes this whole coup against Venezuela situation look even more shady and despicable, if that's even possible when we're talking about U.S. imperialism. Haitians have been protesting their current government under a guy called Moise, who is the successor to Michel Martelly. And if you remember Martelly, he was basically installed by Hillary Clinton. The Haitian people didn't vote for him in the first round of elections. Martelly came in third. People didn't want him. Clinton got on a plane when she was Secretary of State here and demanded that Martelly be put back on the ballot. He was. He ended up president. So what is happening in Haiti is that fuel prices have shot through the roof, and Haitian people are angry that billions of dollars that came from Venezuela through what's called the Petrocaribe Fund, where Venezuela would allow Haiti to purchase low-cost fuel from them and provide financial aid to them. Well, that money from Venezuela has disappeared. And there were 17 people in the Martelly administration who were targeted under an investigation for stealing this money. The people of Haiti were wondering what was going on. This corruption over this Petrocaribe Fund continued under Jovenel Moise. Fuel prices skyrocketed. At the same time, this U.S. coup of Venezuela has occurred. So people in Haiti were taking to the streets in opposition of their government at the same time that we're seeing this lopsided coverage about Venezuela coming out, but there was no coverage in the United States about this uprising in Haiti. And I think that's important because then this coup in Venezuela becomes a bigger deal. It becomes a bigger issue than just Venezuela, because then you have to start asking, why are we targeting, we, the United States government, trying to overthrow a government that's helping one of the poorest nations in the Caribbean? There is a connection there that our media, our government does not want us to pay attention to.
You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear.
Loud and Clear.